Goddag og velkommen til Langsomme Samtaler. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Jeg har i den her uge talt med Jenny King, som er direktør for Climate Research and Policy i London, som er et institut, der holder øje med information om klima, og som har lavet en fantastisk interessant rapport om misinformation og disinformation om klima i dag, og som har det mest kvalificerede svar på et spørgsmål, som jeg meget længe har tænkt over, nemlig, når nu klimabenægterne har tabt, hvordan kan det så være, at det er så svært alligevel at opnå enighed om, hvad problemet med klimaforandringerne er, og ikke mindst, hvad løsningerne er. For vi må jo erkende, at det meget, meget brede flertal i dag tror på videnskaben i den forstand, at de erkender, at klimaforandringerne er menneskeskabte, og at de erkender sammenhængen mellem nogle bestemte gasser, udledninger af dem, og så de forandringer, vi allerede nu kan konstatere i vores klima, og om hvilke vi ved, det bliver kun værre i fremtiden. Så klimabenægterne har tabt. Alligevel kan vi konstatere, at de mest basale forhold omkring klima konstant bliver udfordret og er genstand for strid. Vi kan se, hvordan klima er blevet en del af det, de i Amerika kalder for The Culture Wars, og hvordan spørgsmålet om batterier, elektriske biler, solvind, solenergi, vindenergi, alle mulige energikilder konstant bliver udfordret. Indimellem er jeg i tvivl om, det bare er fordi, at det at håndtere klimaforandringen er så ekstremt kompliceret en politisk proces, at man bliver nødt til at udfordre alle elementerne i det, hvis ikke man vil have et grønt industrielt kompleks, hvor man har et oplyst enevælde og nogle meget stærke kapitalinteresser, der for statsstøtte driver det hele igennem. Eller om det er sådan, at de aktører, der for 20, 30, 40 år siden udfordrede præmissen, at klimaforandringerne er menneskeskabte, i dag har fundet andre måder at udfordre det på. Hvor kommer uvisheden om klima fra? Hvem er kilderne til misinformation, og hvordan modgår man dem? Disse for vores samtid fuldstændigt fundamentale spørgsmål har Jenny King forsket i og lavet en fantastisk rapport om, og vil i den her samtale levere de mest kvalificerede svar på. Her følger min samtale med Jenny King. I've really looked forward to this because I know I'm going to learn a lot from you.
Oh, no pressure.
Well, first we always open with a personal question, and there are kind of two ways into this field. One is if you're interested in epistemology and information and the infrastructure of news and knowledge. The other is if you're a climate activist and you wanted to know why you can't beat the denialists or the disinformers. What was your way into the field?
Definitely more the former than the latter. So I do not have a climate-specific background, and the organization that I work for, ISD, our mandate does also not include climate action explicitly. So our mission statement as an organization is to try and safeguard democracy against three intersecting threats, and that is polarization, disinformation, and hate and extremism. And the reason why we ended up training our lens or our eye on climate is because around 4 or 5 years ago, we became aware that a lot of the communities that we had been following and a lot of the phenomena that we had been following for really a decade had suddenly shifted to thinking about climate issues and environmental themes. And that began to raise an alarm for us that this was a very new era for the climate conversation and that it was likely to fall victim to the kind of trend that we'd seen around public health and migration and sexual and reproductive health rights and racial justice and civil rights, where it becomes a kind of political football and a weaponized conversation to try and draw people into conspiratorial mindsets, into us versus them dynamics, and into kind of preying on social division. So I was very much viewing it through that angle of information ecosystems and really threats to democracy writ large, and the fact that unfortunately climate is sort of the new point of entry into that very fractious environment.
I imagine climate must be very, very difficult because there are, you know, in health, of course, is difficult as well. But in climate expertise, there are so many unknowns. You know, you can't have, if you look at what one climate expert says, 1 year proves to be not wrong, but just limited. the next year. And you know, there was a young person saying to me the other day, I don't like climate news because it's worse than the experts expected. So I imagine that must be a very difficult topic in itself when it comes to disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, to an extent, I think that we've become over-fixated with trying to categorize individual pieces of content. And the reality is that there's not always a neat distinction between misinformation, propaganda, wider information warfare, you know, emotional manipulation through content. But because these terms have become very popular, and particularly after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, you know, the concept of disinformation became a big zeitgeist topic in the public sphere, is that we've almost boxed ourselves into a corner by trying to create these really neat categories and thinking about it at a far too granular level, rather than looking at the intentions behind content. Who is posting it? Why are they posting it? And how much of public discourse, how much of the oxygen is it taking up in the public sphere? And I think as you've seen a shift in the climate space from denialism, so, you know, rejecting the idea that climate change exists at all, that kind of historic field of content, through to these much subtler forms of discourses of delay or climate skepticism, or sometimes it's called lukewarmerism, it's harder and harder to apply that language always of mis and disinformation. And it also obscures, I think, the bigger problem and the bigger harms of what we're really facing in terms of our information ecosystems. So in some cases, it can still be useful language. And of course, there are plenty of things that the scientific community has consensus on, in particular, the kind of basic realities of climate change as a problem, the scale and the urgency of that threat, and the need for kind of comprehensive action. But you're absolutely right that when it comes down to the more specifics of the net zero transition or what climate action and climate policy looks like in practice, there is absolutely a huge amount that still needs to be debated and discussed and ultimately agreed with the general public.
You know, you have people like, let's take an example from someone who's definitely not a climate denialist, like the Joe Biden administration. They would say, we've passed the Inflation Reduction Act. You don't need to sacrifice your energy consumption, but we need to make renewables work. We need to make these huge tax cuts. We need to give these tax benefits. And then we can transition to another energy economy. You know, you'd have some people on the left saying, well, that's disinformation. That's disinformation, because they're pretending that we don't have to change our level of energy consumption. Then you have someone on the right like Donald Trump, and I've just seen some of his rallies, and some of it is obviously disinformation. Where do you draw the line? How do you operate with the kind of minimal definition of disinformation?
So in the work that we've done, and certainly in forming this coalition called Climate Action Against Disinformation, which has around 50 organizations in it, you know, my team does not pretend to be climate science experts, and nor do we want to be. You know, we're not there to arbitrate individual pieces of content, but we do work with partners like the Union of Concerned Scientists, for example, if we're looking at efforts to discredit renewable energies, right? Where are the boundaries of totally legitimate discourse and, you know, real trade-offs and potential downsides and pitfalls? You know, what are good faith conversations around that public policy area? But more than that, we're really trying to look at whole information ecosystems, right? So often we're looking at really outlandish conspiracy theories around climate where there is not a lot of gray area. You know, people who are accusing climate scientists or those working on climate policy as being part of some shadowy elite who are trying to control society and who are using climate as an excuse to kind of justify authoritarianism. People who believe that the climate change is not a problem at all. People who believe all sorts of unsubstantiated claims. So quite a lot of the time we feel on quite firm territory in saying this is at the very least misinformation. We can't say that people are spreading it with and the intention to deceive. Maybe they genuinely believe these things, but they are misguided in those beliefs. And there's plenty of sound evidence to prove why that's the case. But you're right. There is a lot of things that are being called mis- and disinformation, which are really just public policy debates about the pace and the scale of decarbonization. And generally, we would not try and wade into those conversations because it's not what we're interested in. And the reality is that it's also not what disinformation actors are interested in, right? They don't care about the nuance of climate policy. They're actually not trying to engage with the substance of any of these conversations around renewable energies or tax subsidies or, you know, heat pump installation. They are stuck in what I would call the antechamber of discussion, where it's all about climate action being an insidious plot, you know, designed to control you and take away everything you love, right? And it's preventing us from having those very vital conversations about climate policy, because we just end up kind of bogged down in this total morass of wild, outlandish, extremist, hateful, misleading, divisive, incendiary claims, and never actually kind of getting down to the heart of the issue. But when we're thinking about this topic within the coalition, we've tried to create a little bit of nuance in a definition of what we would consider climate mis- and disinformation. And we categorize that under three tiers. So tier one is probably your kind of historic or traditional understanding, and that's outright rejection of climate change as a problem. So these are people who actively deny the science or try to undermine that science, and who also reject the relationship between human activity and fossil fuels and shifts in the environment, right? So that anthropogenic angle of climate change. The second tier is probably much more relevant now, right? This is the kind of content that is most popular in public life, and it gains a huge amount of traction both online and in legacy media. And that's what I referred to earlier as kind of delayism or discourses of delay. So these are, you know, efforts to use to cherry pick science or to misrepresent scientific findings in order to slow down policymaking or to confuse the public about what the viable pathways forward really are, and also to attack and dehumanize people who are figureheads in the movement. So climate scientists, you know, multilateral institutions, climate policymakers, climate activists. And then the third pillar, which has been a problem, you know, really going back 50 or 60 years now, or you might call greenwashing, right? So these are types of content, usually coming from industry players or corporate actors, that present themselves as being supportive of climate action, when actually the things that they're proposing, the so-called solutions, are totally in contravention of the scientific consensus, right? They don't align with our understanding of the problem, and they certainly don't offer real credible pathways forward to achieve the goals of something like the Paris Agreement. So that's our framework that we use within ISD, my organization, and CAD, our wider coalition, to try and show that there are very different levels of engagement with this problem and different tactics that actors are using to try and shape the public conversation.
My somewhat simplistic understanding of it, of the history of this field, is that you had some quite rude strategies in the 60s and the 70s that were very much about, is this a problem? Is it a man-made problem? And now it seems incredibly advanced. Like, you'd meet people and say, of course, no doubt we are harming the planet. There's just nothing we can do about it. Or you'll meet people saying, well, I know climate change is real, but I just don't believe in the policies that will get us there. Have you ever seen what batteries look like? But that is just my dilettante conception, that it was more simple maybe 30 or 40 years ago. And today it's extremely complicated. It's a wide variety of strategies. How do you see this?
You're absolutely right. And part of that is a deliberate and conscious tactic, right? So public perception has shifted hugely since the 1970s. And most polling now in the European Union, for example, or even in North America, in parts of the global south, populations believe or understand the reality of climate change as a problem. And there is also generally support for the idea of government-led action. However, there is an enormous amount of confusion and the potential to exploit that confusion in what the pathway forward looks like. So how do you achieve effective mitigation and adaptation strategies? So from industry's perspective, they've had to shift, right? The kinds of narrative lines that they were using in the 1970s are no longer palatable. They're not going to have the same kind of traction as they did previously. It's much harder. It's still not impossible. And, you know, if you look at some of the candidates in elections at the moment, it's a worrying sort of return to the 1970s. But it is generally less common now that people can stand up in public life and say climate change doesn't exist, right? Because people will laugh at them and say, you don't seem credible. That's, you know, we have enough of a basic understanding of the problem to know that that isn't accurate. So instead, they are focusing their resources and this incredibly professionalized PR and lobbying ecosystem on the gap between recognition of a problem and actually doing something about that problem. And that is a very important gap, right? I often refer to it as the final mile, right? It's great if you can have a base level of understanding amongst the general public, but if it doesn't translate into meaningful action and we never actually pass legislation or, you know, regulation, or we don't have multilateral strategies for this, then it's almost the same as denying the problem, right? You end up with the same outcome, which is complete paralysis. So yes, there has been a conscious pivot from corporate actors and all of the vast network of people that they launder their ideas through, right? The ways that they mainstream those ideas into the general public through legacy media outlets, through think tanks, through professional PR agencies. But the other thing that's really changed in the last 5 years, and I think that this is part of what you're observing, is how many actors have flooded into this space and stand to benefit from climate mis and disinformation who are not fossil fuel companies. So, you know, when people think about climate mis and disinformation, they imagine exclusively Exxon or Total or BP or Saudi Aramco, right? And they're thinking about it in quite crude financial terms. Like, the only people who would care about spreading this content are those who are financially invested in the carbon economy and want to maintain reliance on fossil fuels. And that is one universe of actors, but it is by no means the only game in town anymore, unfortunately. And there is now this whole set of other actors who are pushing this content for different reasons, ideological reasons, you know, personal brand reasons. And that includes people who benefit from the outrage economy online or the attention economy. So they actually have very little interest in climate change as an issue, but they know that it's now controversial. And it's a good way of gaining engagement, right? Of cultivating an audience on social media. It gets likes, it gets clicks, it gets comments, it gets shares. And so they spread mis and disinformation alongside mis and disinformation on a whole other range of issues, elections, gender, racial justice, because it's just part of a bigger ideological platform. You also have foreign states who are spreading this kind of content, sometimes because they have geopolitical goals. So if you think about Russia, they kind of have an incentive to spread this content because they want people to buy Russian gas and have trade links. But it's not just about that. They've also seen that as climate becomes part of the culture wars, they can stoke division in so-called hostile enemy states, right? So they will spread all sorts of narratives around climate in Germany or in other parts of the European Union or in parts of the global south. And there's not always coherence in those messages. The main outcome is to seed chaos and to make climate as divisive an issue as possible so that it tears apart society, so that it undermines the fabric of trust between citizens and their governments, so that it kind of increases tensions between countries, particularly countries in the global north and countries in the global south. So, you know, they're another set of actors. And then you also now have far-right political movements who are doing something quite similar. They're kind of latching on to climate, not because they're necessarily financially invested in Exxon or have a vested interest there, but because they've seen it as a way to mobilize a new audience, that they can use climate as symbolic of all of these bigger themes around power and government overreach and individual agency and control over the future. And climate just happens to be a convenient vector for them. It's not because they necessarily have strong viewpoints about the net zero transition. It's because it's useful and they are being opportunistic.
I know it's very difficult to make a genealogy of a discourse, but I remember 4 or 5 years ago noticing how all of a sudden climate discourse was part of the culture wars. But, and it fit perfectly, I must say. That I noticed immediately how it was people in the countryside against people in the cities, regular people against experts. You have these abstract solutions that were connected to some kind of moralism, who are the good people and who are the wrong people. And I think over the last 4 or 5 years, we've really seen it accelerating. And we've got this European parliamentary election will be very much influenced by that. I know this is a big question, but how did this happen? How did climate discourse meet the culture wars? Is there a kind of way of tracing that back?
I mean, it's very difficult to look at an origin point. I would say that in part, it will intersect with some of those traditional industry actors, right? Is that they have funded, for example, the far-right media outlets for decades. And so they have a financial stake in the information environment writ large, right? They're not just doing PR and traditional advertising, but they are major donors and they're propping up large parts of the legacy media, newspapers, broadcast, radio. And as they've pivoted their tactical playbook, they've also identified these opportunities, right? I think generally, mis and disinformation thrive in times of crisis. And it happens at this moment in time that we're living through about 6 or 10 intersecting crises all happening at once. And I really think that the COVID-19 pandemic was a turbocharging moment for a lot of these harms. So it's not that they didn't exist previously, but they were thrown into much sharper relief by, you know, the turmoil of that period. And what you saw during that time was that all of these very unexpected communities were forming in the online space because people were desperately seeking out information about the public health crisis. And people were also furious. They had real legitimate grievances and trauma about the ways that government handled that crisis and communicated with the public about the crisis. And so let's say you had, you know, thousands of new Facebook groups or WhatsApp groups or Telegram groups that originally formed because people were trying to get access to information about this rapidly evolving situation. But after the pandemic kind of faded a little bit into the background of public life, those spaces still existed. And they brought together very diverse and quite unexpected sets of people. And those spaces began to be weaponized by those with agendas, political agendas, ideological agendas, financial agendas. And you saw a lot of them being pivoted towards opposition to climate action or opposition to, you know, migration policies or opposition to anything else that is considered to be partisan or contentious or part of the culture wars. So at a very kind of logistical, practical level, the pandemic created this entirely new space where pockets of the population were coming into contact with people online in a way that they never would have done previously. And that gave bad actors a kind of unprecedented audience to engage and to talk to them directly, right? Not having to work through intermediaries, not having to go via the press, not even having to go through kind of high traction social media accounts, but kind of engaging with people in a way that felt authentic and organic and grassroots. And then, you know, beyond that, I think a lot of this is trial and error, right? People who make their money off being controversial online and cultivating this brand of going against the mainstream and being contrarians and speaking truth to power is they're constantly testing new ways of kind of agitating the public and trying to gain followers and an audience. And so I'm sure that they tried 1,000 things alongside climate, and indeed they are putting climate next to a number of other contentious issues, right? But clearly at some point in time, they began to see that climate was getting them the sort of engagement that they were looking for. And then they doubled down and they continue to post that. And it's, you know, it's very transactional in some sense, right? It's actually not to do with their particular interest in a particular policy issue. It's just what is going to give them the maximum visibility and allow them to get that kind of clout and online audience and following, which then translates into a business model, right? You can generate advertising revenue. You can sell merchandise. You can funnel people towards subscription-based content. And suddenly you've got a viable financial structure just from sitting behind a keyboard at home and spreading kind of wild, outlandish claims about the world. So, you know, I think it's all of these things happening in tandem that's really led us to where we are now.
And that also explains why we see people who could be quite old, who are not engaged in climate 10 years ago, who are only talking about gender or race or the great replacement theories, who are now all of a sudden engaging with climate, because it's one of the efficient weapons in the war.
Yeah. And, you know, previously, I think climate felt like more of a specialist or a niche conversation. Like, lots of people were passively interested in it, but unless they were actively seeking out information, the likelihood of them being exposed to it online was perhaps smaller, right? It felt like quite a technocratic conversation of nerdy people, you know, scientists and those who were against climate policy or industry actors in quite isolated spaces arguing with each other, right? About things that most people couldn't be bothered to understand because they felt very, very abstract or really complicated. Whereas what's happening now is that all of these influencers, so people who have really tens of millions of followers across social media and who are not climate experts and actually have no background in science, have piggybacked on this controversy, this kind of culture wars framing of climate, because, as I said, it gets them the likes and the clicks and the comments. But what that means is that a far, far wider audience in the general public will happen upon this kind of content when they're casually browsing their news feeds. And that is a completely different paradigm to what we have before, because it means that actually people with minimal knowledge or understanding, and indeed people who are actively quite cynical and opportunistic, are shaping the public conversation. And they're doing that often for this kind of personal gain rather than to actually produce a good faith discussion about climate action. But they have enormous organic reach, and they also retain quite a lot of trust and credibility with their audience. And I really don't think that the science sector or the policymaker sector has caught up to that new reality, right? And they're kind of constantly asking, why are we struggling to break through? We're the ones that have all of the data and evidence. Like, why is nobody listening to us? And it's just a completely outdated understanding of who people turn to understand the world and to navigate these really complex issues. And the reality is, it's not those traditional institutions. It is online influencers and bloggers and, you know, people on social media, regardless of what their credentials are.
One of the very, very interesting things about your report that came out a couple of years ago is the way that you categorize these discourses of delay. And I think most of them will recognize discourse of the delay when they see them, as soon as you have a concept. They're all of them very good, but one of them is unreliable renewables, which is, and I've just been in America to cover the Trump primaries, and it was all about unreliable renewables. You know, they want to put renewables in the American military. We will lose, or the batteries will never work. Can you tell a little bit about this kind of discourse of delay when it comes to renewables?
Yeah, absolutely. And I cannot take credit at all for the discourses of delay kind of framework that predates even our work into this space, but it's incredibly useful. And I would really encourage people, we use the diagrams in our report, but there's also a fantastic comic book version that was done by a lady called Celine Keller. And it's so easy to understand. It's really digestible. And if you're trying to explain these topics to somebody else, I would share that as a resource. I've kind of sent it to everybody I know, because I think it's a really amazing distillation of a lot of these arguments. But the efforts to discredit renewables comes under a category that we would call sort of emphasizing the downsides of the energy transition and also pushing non-transformative solutions. And these are both really effective strategies, because rather than denying the reality of climate change, which is, as we've said, is kind of a lot less popular than it might have been 10 years ago, it plants the seeds of doubt in people's minds so that they really do not understand what are the strategies that are going to be effective and that also are going to kind of impact them and their daily lives. And what it creates is this feeling that you can just tinker around the margins of the problem without ever tackling like the big structural issues. And because the general public are kind of desperate for good news stories, it creates this opening for industry to say, don't worry, we won't actually have to adapt anything. We're going to create these magical silver bullet solutions that will suck carbon out of the atmosphere and nothing else needs to change. So don't worry about the Paris Agreement and don't worry about, you know, national strategies. Just leave it to industry, go with that old school free market approach and come back to us in 10 years' time and we'll have everything resolved. But alongside that, they have to make sure that any of the kind of opposition technologies, wind, solar, hydroelectric, are discredited and are attacked as much as possible. And what you'll see happen is, let's say there's a natural disaster or there's an extreme cold snap, like you saw in Texas a few years ago, and you have blackouts in the energy grid, is, even though this has no basis in reality, how easy it is to blame those events on renewable energy and say, this is a specter of the future. You're going to freeze in your homes and your relatives are going to die and you will not be able to pay your energy bills because we have based all of our infrastructure on these totally unreliable, not fit for purpose technologies like wind and solar. When in reality, that was the exact opposite of what had happened in Texas. But it didn't matter, right? Because that narrative quite quickly became the defining story in the public consciousness. And it really rose to the fore of media coverage. And I sometimes refer to that kind of mis and disinformation as sticky, right? It lasts a very long time. However much you try and flood the zone with evidence and facts and, you know, fact checks, it doesn't work, right? That stuff becomes embedded in people's understanding of the problem. So it's been one of the most popular forms of opposition that we've seen. And it comes not just from industry, but also from all of the other actors that I talked about earlier in this interview, right? People in the outrage economy, hostile states, and far-right political movements. They're all discrediting renewables because there's quite a neat narrative playbook. And they don't have to be very creative or inventive, right? It always comes back to the same central themes. And quite often they're recycling even the same images and memes. So we found one example a few years ago that claimed to show a wind turbine being de-iced by a diesel helicopter. And the claim was, look at these nonsense liberal lefties who are pushing climate action. They can't even get their wind turbines to run without fossil fuel, you know, helicopters that are coming in and de-icing them. And it had absolutely no relation to the news story that it was being associated with. That picture went all the way back to, I think, 2011 from, you know, Scandinavia. And it also didn't represent what they were saying it did. None of that matters because it's a very potent image that short circuits people's critical thinking and goes straight to a kind of emotional core in people. It doesn't require any language skills. It doesn't require any sort of knowledge of science, right? It's just a neat image that lodges in people's brains and ends up shaping their understanding of this whole public policy issue.
When we look at how to counter these disinformation campaign and these this discourse. I'm not an expert here, but it seems to me that the media infrastructure is extremely important. That in America, every time I'm in America, I think, well, they really need something like the BBC. They really need something that has some kind of, I know the BBC is also contested, but not to the extent that the American media are. And if you look at here in Scandinavia, we also have national broadcasting companies, and of course we from the private media, we moan about them, but they do give us a sense of shared reality, and this is where we all look. Can you say anything about kind of the premises for a media infrastructure that allows us to establish common understandings?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and it can cut both ways. You know, the problem of where we're at now is that climate action is considered to be a partisan issue, which is absolutely extraordinary when you think that it boils down to the sustainability of our planet and our ability to kind of continue to exist as a human race, right? That should have nothing to do with political divisions or what label you associate yourself with or what tribe you vote for in a given election. And yet somehow we've reached this perverse position where even saying that you support climate action is considered to be left-wing in a number of contexts. And that is reflected by partisan media in a number of places. And I think, you know, the US is probably an extreme example where the sheer fact that a certain outlet is writing about a story already colors people's understanding of the content of the article itself, right? Whether it's coming from Fox News or from CNN or from MSNBC will affect how you perceive the information. And that, it makes it impossible to have collective conversations about these really vital issues. At the same time, I do think that we need to be quite sober to the fact that legacy media has played a really vital and ongoing role in laundering mis- and disinformation into the public sphere. And that quite a lot of these bad actors have long-standing relationships with newspapers and broadcasters in order to mainstream these positions and reach the widest possible audience. And that is not a problem that, you know, happened in the 1970s and 1980s and is no longer taking place. That is absolutely front and center in how our information ecosystems work, is that you often end up with this almost tripod system where you'll have, let's say, a set of industry actors and their sponsored think tanks and PR agents. And they're developing a highly professional narrative playbook and tactical playbook. They are then working and making sure that they are platformed and have a kind of continual home for their ideas within the legacy media. And that then translates into allies within the political sphere who, you know, say, oh, well, this is credible because it's being reported by this mainstream media outlet. And it becomes a mutually reinforcing circle of actors, right? One who are coming up with the ideas, one who are legitimizing the ideas, and then the third who are translating those ideas into a political reality. So when we think about the role that media plays going forward, we definitely need more reporting on mis- and disinformation in the climate space and who stands to benefit from that content and really raising awareness amongst the general public. And I also think we need scrutiny on media outlets themselves to say, here are the ways that you're being gamed. Here are the ways that you are amplifying and actually compounding harms by platforming certain individuals or by producing advertorials and sponsored content on behalf of fossil fuel companies, and that you do actually need to confront those systemic issues as well yourselves. Otherwise, you are not going to have any credibility within the general public, and you will not be seen as neutral brokers of this very, very important conversation.
Oh, I love this point. I never thought of that. That's a very, very good point, because when, you know, this discourse of fake news kind of exploded and it was everywhere, it was also being used as a marketing model for the legacy media, saying, well, we are the truth. And it seemed a bit misleading. You know, no one has the truth in the public. It should always be contested. So it cuts both ways. It's a wonderful point.
And also just to add on that, you know, there is a great tension within a lot of legacy media outlets who are in very dire financial positions, right? They are really struggling to compete with the models of social media. And a lot of them are going out of business or laying off staff. And it's a real question of what the future of those outlets are going to look like. But there is a tension often between climate reporters who are doing really fantastic work in exposing, you know, corruption and industry lobbying and having, you know, navigating these very complex issues for the public. And then the business side of outlets who are taking advertising money from those same actors, right? And that these fossil fuel companies are actually propping up outlets financially and producing content on their behalf. And, you know, there's a thousand examples. I would really encourage your listeners to look at the work of Amy Westervelt and the podcast Drilled, because they've done a huge amount on this. But, you know, the New York Times is a great example, or the Washington Post or Bloomberg Green, where you'll be reading an article that will be, you know, very nuanced and kind of gold standard reporting on the climate crisis. And the advert next to it will be from Exxon or BP. And you're like, this is a definite contradiction or sort of conflict of interest, in that those traditional industry actors are always looming on the margins of these conversations. And I'm not saying that they are shaping the editorial decisions of papers, but they are very much still influencing the business models of the media industry. And that is a problem going forward. It's a problem for the way that we kind of curate public discussion of the climate crisis.
Another very good point. I have just one last question, because time is running, but it's so interesting to hear you unfold this. That is very, very important to us. You have a lot, you have some policy recommendations in your report, and you've given policy recommendations to the European Parliament as well. If you were to pick one policy recommendation that would make a difference, you can also pick two if you want to.
Wow, now that is the million-dollar question. You know, it's like choosing between your children on the policy front. I mean, if you're talking about tech regulation, I would say, you know, we don't want to separate climate out from the other range of harms. And a lot of the accountability and scrutiny that we want on tech companies would relate to climate as well as, you know, terrorist recruitment or child sexual exploitation or, you know, a lot of the other things that are being debated in public life. And it's about understanding why certain things always seem to rise to the surface of social media. Why is it that misleading content, divisive content, conspiratorial content, hateful and extremist content always seems to get more engagement than verified science? And there has to be something happening in the architecture of these platforms that enables that to be the case. And that's to do with the fact that these business models are based on engagement, right? They're not based on safety. These products were not built for us to have safe and healthy information ecosystems. They were based on trying to keep people online and browsing as long as possible. And that is a kind of fundamentally broken foundation on which to build healthy public discourse. So I think, you know, the biggest recommendation that we have is the conversation already underway within the European Union around the Digital Services Act and the Code of Practice on Disinformation, in having greater transparency from the platforms themselves as why this is taking place. How are the algorithms allowing certain things to dominate the conversation? And how can we mitigate that to kind of level out the playing field? So, you know, greater data access is the first step. And then beyond that, really trying to look at systemic harms rather than getting into this, you know, very contentious and often unconstructive conversation around, well, is each individual piece of content accurate or not accurate, right? Which is it's a total red herring, and it allows them to avoid the real big problem, which is how are your entire business models constructed and what kind of outcomes are they trying to produce, not only for users, but for society as a whole?
Jenny King, thank you so much for your time and for your work. It's been very teaching for me and an inspiration. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Det var så min samtale med Jenny King, som er direktør for Climate Research and Policy. Hvis man går ind på deres hjemmeside, så finder man den rapport, som er omdrejningspunktet for vores samtale. Den her langsomme samtale var produceret af vores vidunderlige, tålmodige, generøse og fleksible ven og hjælper, Albert Kuhlmann. I næste uge skal vi tale med en anden gammel ven af Langsom Samtaler og Dagbladet Information, nemlig den britiske historiker David Runciman. Han har skrevet en ny bog, som er en spektakulær læsning af samtiden, og som er en af den slags synteser mellem idéhistorie, politisk historie og samtidsproblematik, som David Runciman er en mester i. Han fortæller i næste uge om bogen og de store maskiner, der tænker for os, og hvem det er, vi har givet magten til. Mit navn er Rune Lykkeberg. Tak fordi I lyttede med i den her uge. Jeg håber, I lytter med igen i næste uge, når vi får besøg af David Runciman.